This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is Arizona History. Today's reading is from the book titled Tucson Memories, written by Bonnie Henry and published in 2006. Subject area is Western Ways, Article Number 8, Picacho Peak, Pilot Light. It juts up like a purple thumb hitchhiking across the desert, serving for eons as a signpost to the weary traveler. More than 70 years ago, Picacho Peak also offered up beacon lights for pilots needing to put down in a hurry. 4 miles south of the peak sprawled Red Rock Airport, an emergency landing field that received everything from tiny single props to an American Airlines plane forced down by fog. Brother and sister Lou Keesh and Irma Duddle bore witness to it all, living in a small frame house to the northern edge of the dirt runway. To their father, Joseph Keesh, fell the job of periodically climbing Picacho Peak to change out the beacon bulbs. "Daddy used to drive us to the bottom of Picacho Peak. We take a lunch. We had our picnic while Daddy climbed the mountain to check the beacon light," said Duddle. "He told me one time he went up all the way and forgot the key to get the bulb," said the son, who climbed the peak a few years back and still found remnants of the beacon that once flashed out across the valley. The elder Keesh, who from 1935 to 1939 worked for what is now the Federal Aviation Administration, also checked the airport's landing lights. "Daddy took me for walks to replace the bulb," said Duddle, who remembered an airfield entirely surrounded by barbed wire. "The cattle ran loose all over the desert," she said. She and her brother would also check for gopher and rabbit holes on the field for their father to fill. With the gophers and rabbits came the rattlers. "Daddy would kill at least one a week," said Lou Keesh, who came to the airfield as a newborn and left 4 years later when his father's recurring tuberculosis forced a move back to Tucson. "Daddy got TB in Haiti when he was with the Marines," said Duddle. Eventually, the White Plague would bring the family to Tucson in the summer of 33. "He had no pension, no assistance. He was very proud," said Duddle. Her mother finally persuaded her father to ask for help. "All they offered was a bag of turnips," she recalled. No doubt the Red Rock job Joseph Keesh landed in September of 35 was seen as a godsend. Ditto for the house that came with it. 2 bedrooms, running water, and electricity. "We thought it was a mansion," said Lou Keesh. "School was 2 miles to the south in Red Rock. 1 room, grades 1 to 8. A pot-bellied stove and about 15 kids from neighboring ranches filled up the room," said Duddle. "At Christmas time and at other get-togethers, we'd push all the desks together and have dances to a wind-up Victrola. Summer times, the family slept outside on army cots, while a parade of humanity rolled up and down the nearby Casa Grande Highway, precursor to Interstate 10. We'd see these people from the Dust Bowl and the cars packed with their belongings headed toward California," said Duddle. "Once in a while, a plane would land at the L-shaped airfield, including a rather large passenger craft that the family posed in front of in 1939. Later that year, they moved back to Tucson, where the elder Keesh would eventually be cured of TB, living to age 85. Meanwhile, the Red Rock Field developed back in 1927 reverted to windswept desert by the mid-50s. Its mansion trucked to Tucson, where it still stands today," said Lou Keesh. 2 miles south of the old runway, 18-wheelers on I-10 roar by the spot where Duddle once went to school. It's disappeared as well, replaced by a newer building a few blocks away. "It's all gone," said Duddle. "All but the memories." Article Number 9. Link and Ludi. They kept chickens by the thousands, drank water from a natural spring, and fenced out the cows that roamed where a golf course now sprawls. In the mid-1990s, Link and Ludi Wilson still lived on the land, surrounded by million-dollar homes whose occupants would no doubt be aghast at the thought of an actual chicken scratching nearby. We know that land today is a portion of the Coronado Foothills Estates. Up so high in the Catalina Foothills, it actually looks down on Skyline Country Club, my dears. 60 years ago, however, it was little more than busted dreams, played-out mining claims honeycombed with old tunnels. "We still water our citrus and pecan trees with water from the mine," said Ludi, whose front yard butted up to an old mine shaft, complete with pump. It was Link's uncle, Miles Carpenter, who put them up where they would eventually live, she said. A mining man, Carpenter worked the old Texas Arizona Copper Company mine in the foothills back when this century was new. "He had tunnels all over," said Ludi. "One of the shafts is straight in front of us." Other claims also dotted the area. The Pontotoc, the Saratoga, the Pemberton, and Don Jose. From them came mainly copper, along with a little silver and trace of gold, said Niall Nemeth of the state's Department of Mines and Mineral Resources. "It was relatively weak copper along the Catalina Foothills fault," said Nemeth about the foothill mines in general. "It was hand-picked ore. What looked good, they put in a sack, loaded on mules, and shipped. What didn't look good, they dumped here." By the 1940s, however, the mines had long played out. Carpenter was dead, and his widow was looking for a deal. She got his mining claims as clear property, and in 1947, we bought it from her. 116 acres for $20,000, said Ludi. On the property stood Carpenter's former SA office, as well as a cook shack. At the time of the sale, Ludi was teaching in Marana. Link was working for the railroad. They rented out their house in town and became pioneers. "We moved into the cook shack," said Ludi. The shack would form the middle of their house, which was greatly expanded. Light came from a kerosene lantern and later by generator. Water came piped in from Pontotoc Springs, less than a mile from their house. "It was a good force of water," said Ludi. "I ran a washing machine with it." At one time, Indians camped near the springs, but by the time the Wilsons moved into the area, it was covered with a pump house, said Ludi. Pontotoc Road, which once led to the mine, was one lane and rocky, and the only road to their place. "We practically rebuilt the road," said Ludi, describing how she and a daughter-in-law would stand on railroad cross ties that had been chained to a truck and dragged slowly across the road. "We gave the cross ties leverage," she said. Thankfully, they only did that a few times. Then Link found out that Pontotoc was a dedicated road, and he got the county to maintain it. The closest grocery stores was miles away. Same for the telephone. Deer, bobcats, coyotes, snakes, and skunks were plentiful. Human neighbors were harder to come by. "Once in a while, we'd see people on horseback," said Ludi. "They'd come up to our door, lost, and say, 'Do you know where I am?'" Artist Ted DeGrazia also came calling. "He drove up here one time and about scared me silly," said Ludi, who invited him in. "He wanted to buy our property." The answer was no. During storms, water would course down from the mountains, filling the gullies. "The auroras were much deeper and more active then," said Ludi. "Water would come flying down." Some of that mountain runoff was later trapped in a three-sided basin large enough to contain a speeding motorboat. "Link and our son Larry used a bulldozer and a scraper to build up the fourth side," said Ludi. "Eventually, the county breached the dam," said Ludi, "because neighbors south of it were afraid it would break." After Link retired in the 50s, the Wilson got into eggs. Big time. "We called it Pontotoc Ranch," said Ludi. "We decided to raise chickens for the eggs. We had as many as 4,000 hens." But the venture only lasted a few years. For progress was coming, in the form of developers. They were going to cut up the land in lots. We were on the edge of it. "Rather than oppose it, we decided to join in," said Ludi. In 1961, the Wilsons sold all but 5 of their acres to a group of Eastern businessmen. The lots would become part of Coronado Foothills Estates. Before this happened, we were thinking of reopening the mine. But we decided we couldn't have a mine in the midst of all this prosperity, said Ludi. Just down the road, more plans were unveiled for a swanky new country club and homes to be built east of Swan Road, where cattle once grazed. Its name, Skyline Country Club. The shoulders for Swan Road, just below Skyline, were made from the ore bed in our front yard, said Ludi. Over the years, Link and others also engineered many of the other roads snaking through the foothills. Link could hold on to a jackhammer longer than any of the men, said Ludi. But road development also meant the end of the lovely springs that had pumped water to the Wilsons for so long. By that time, the pump house was gone, and engineers ran the road right over the springs, said Ludi, whose home by then had been connected to a regular water utility. By the mid-1990s, the Wilsons' ranch house would be dwarfed by multi-million-dollar monuments jutting here and there on the cliffs. Asked how she felt about that, Ludi replied, "They are castles. They're so pretty. It's all right, as far as I'm concerned." Note, Link Wilson died in 1997. Ludi died in 2000. Article number 10, Tumbleweed Ranch. When old times harp on and on about this shopping center or that car lot used to be nothing but desert, believe. Believe that the intersection of Swan and Speedway once looked like the middle of nowhere a mere 7 decades ago. Believe that there were no stoplights, no traffic, no sprawl. Believe that you could ride a horse east all the way to the rising moon, easing itself up over the Rincons. A.W. Scrap Roberts believed. I had the idea to build some stables, said Roberts, whose previous encounters with a horse consisted mainly of ROTC cavalry drills at the University of Arizona. No matter. In 1936, he started buying up real estate along Speedway, just west of Swan Road, then a dirt strip just aching for a landing. A few years later, a friend with an airplane would do just that, with Robert sitting next to him in the cockpit. There were no cars then, he said, referring to today's hectic traffic. A California boy, Roberts had come east to Tucson in 1934 to enroll at the University of Arizona and play a little football under J.F. Pop McHale. It was McHale, by the way, who first called him Scrap. The following year, he bought the old college hangout known as the Varsity Inn. His involvement didn't last long. Too much time and not enough money, said Roberts. Besides, there was all that desert out there. All those financial possibilities. My mother and dad had come out here by then, and we started buying up more and more land, said Roberts. By the time they were done, they owned everything from Swan Road to Venice Avenue, Speedway to Fairmont Street. 40 acres altogether, snapped up, he said, for $2,000 an acre. One of the lots they bought fronting Speedway already held a house. We paid $16,000 for the house and 1 acre, said Roberts, who made that the family home. Electricity was in. So was the water, supplied from a well. We put in 2 more wells, dug down 100 feet. Back then, the water was good. Into the ground went alapo pines, pepper trees, oleanders, and a hand-dug swimming pool. It was the only one for miles around, said Roberts. It cost $700 to build. By the early 40s, he was calling the whole thing Tumbleweed Ranch, named for the stickery bushes regularly rolling on by. Coyotes and javelina ambled by the front porch. Out back, behind the property, squatted a turkey farm and a former speakeasy. If it was neighbors they wanted, neighbors they soon got, residing in small rental cottages. Roberts and his dad Floyd built on the property. There were 7 little houses, 2-bedroom, 1 bath, brick and plaster, said Roberts. We rented them for $50 a month. Later, it went to $75. Among the tenants, Hollywood film crews, an opera singer who came out here from New York, and plenty of health seekers. They brought one woman out in a car with the seat turned down. She was lying down, said Roberts. Pretty soon she had a couple of crutches. She left us walking. On the southeast portion of the property, Roberts put in his stables and riding arena, offering instruction in both English and Western riding. Tenderfoots and tourists showed up, along with students from St. Joseph's Academy and Arizona Sunshine School. One Saturday night, Roberts asked a young woman to dance at the Desert Shores Supper Club. For crying out loud, there he was wearing cowboy clothes with stuff on his boots, said Virginia Roberts. Nevertheless, she accepted his invitation to dance. They married in 1942. Out to the ranch she went. I was a wrangler right from the beginning, said Virginia, who also helped out Scrap's mother, Ann, with the cooking. We had two cowboys, Shorty and Ed, who lived in the bunkhouse, said Virginia, but we fed them in the kitchen. 60 head of horses lived on the ranch at one time, including Scrap's beloved war chief. We hauled in our hay all the way from Yuma, said Scrap. Friday nights were reserved for stake rides. The horses used a trail off of Swan Road that went clear to Wilmot Road, said Virginia. On the way back, Scrap and the riders would stop at the old Venice Gardens, later known as the Palomino, for a beer. That's when he'd call me and say, "Put on the stakes," said Virginia. Total cost for the ride and the grub, $2.50. During wartime, said Virginia, we had a time getting the stakes, but we saved our stamps. While stakes may have been scarce during the war, not so tenants. Houses were hard to come by, said Scrap. All the cottages were filled. By the war's end, Scrap's parents had moved back to California, and Scrap and Virginia were busy raising two boys. Another kind of growth was also occurring, as others discovered the east side. We started noticing there was less access to the horse trail, said Virginia. Again, seizing opportunity, Scrap leased out a corner of the property for a gas station. Despite civilization's inroads, Tumbleweed Ranch still tried to keep it horsey. Every year at rodeo time, we take all the horses down to the rodeo parade for others to ride, said Virginia. People would pay us $3. We saddled every horse, 60 of them, then took them down 22nd Street. Speedway, it seems, had become too citified for horses' hooves. Looming assessments for road improvements finally forced them to sell in the mid-50s. People were circulating petitions to have the roads paved, said Scrap. It would have cost us a fortune. So they sold it all to an out-of-town buyer. The property, the main house, the cottages, the stables. We sold the horses and 100 saddles, said Scrap. The hardest was selling War Chief. The new owner tore it all down, said Virginia. That killed us when he tore down the houses and filled in the swimming pool. For years, said Virginia, the land stood vacant. The new owner got offers, but nobody could get it financing. Meanwhile, Scrap and Virginia built a new home not far from the old Tumbleweed Ranch. Today, the ranch where Scrap saddled up and Virginia cooked steaks so far out in the desert is filled with commerce. Article number 11, Tohono O'Chul. Never underestimate the power of a mint julep. John Wack remembered what they did to him. We had a luncheon with Reverend and Mrs. George Ferguson. He was the founding rector of St. Philip's in the Hills Church. After the mint juleps, they took us out and showed us some land for sale. Between their powers of persuasion and the mint juleps, we bought the land, 80 acres. The ice long ago melted in those frosty glasses, but the legacy of the land and the house Wack would build upon it almost 70 years ago lives on in that refuge from urban life that we all know as Tohono O'Chul Park. Today, it's a 49-acre nature preserve, complete with winding desert trails, exhibitions, art and gift galleries, and a tea room. A corner of desert treasure tucked behind the busy intersection of Ina and Oracle Roads. 85 years ago, only cattle roamed through the brush and the cacti there, on land homesteaded by T.T. Muzzy. Then came along Sam W. Seney, who homesteaded 640 acres and subdivided it into large, multi-acre lots that would one day bear the rather civilized name Catalina Citrus Estates. Seney's daughter, Cornelia Lovett, remembered the rather uncivilized aspects about the property, however. "My father built a little cabin right behind where Tohono O'Toole is now. He homesteaded there. My mother and I would come out on the weekends. Oracle was not paved, and when the Rialto was running, you couldn't cross." His father drilled the property first well on, of all things, a hill. What's amazing is it didn't have to go down very far for water. Desert creatures, of course, abounded. "I had a little dog I loved who was yapping outside the door of the cabin," recalled Lovett. "We opened the door to let him in, and a coyote came running in, too. Stopped in the middle of the room, turned around, and ran out." Polo brought Wach, who played on the Santa Barbara, California team, to town and to that auspicious lunch with the Ferguson in 1936. Maurice Reed, who developed the oasis of palms and citrus on Orange Grove Road, is the one who sold them the land, $200 an acre. Gene Reed, Maurice's son, remembered how it was done back then. "We had a little 10-horse Caterpillar tractor. We cut a little trail so we could get vehicles in there to show prospective buyers. That's why the roads are all so crooked out there. We worked around the major plants." The Reeds landscaped the property with orchards worth of grapefruit trees tucked in from Phoenix, along with more than a dozen date palms. Using the plans of a Santa Barbara architect, the Wachs hired Paul Holton to build their house. Adobe blocks for the 18-inch thick walls were made on the site, and massive ponderosa pine ceiling beams were hauled down Mount Lemmon's rustic back road. French doors to catch the breeze and that rarity known as a private swimming pool were the home's only cooling devices. But progress was on the march. By the time the home was completed in 1937, electric lines and pavement were both snaking up on Oracle Road. Ironically, the home's first owner spent little, if any, time there. "We ended up building the house for my father, Henry Wellington Wach, who was the founder and first editor of Field & Stream magazine," said John Wach. Other likewise esteemed occupants would follow. By the end of World War II, the Ellicott home, so far out in the desert, had passed through the ownership of two more out-of-town families, one from Boston, the other from Pittsburgh. How much time either spent in the house, no one seems to know. But just about everyone in America knew the popular radio shows created by the home's next occupant, scriptwriter Clifford Goldsmith. The man who introduced the character Henry Aldrich and his trademark, "Coming, Mother," into the American consciousness, rented the home in 1946. His son Barclay Goldsmith, who lived in the house as a child, remembered his father banging out scripts for the Aldrich family in an office that would later house Tohono O'Toole's gift shop. "My father had spent so much time away from home, I think that was an attempt to be more of a family. It was a treat for him," said Goldsmith about the man who indeed would make his home in Tucson until the day he died in 1971. He remembered lots of back-and-forth calls between New York and Tucson and a steady stream of visitors, some of them world-famous. "Claude Rains stayed there, I know." 10 years after its adobe walls went up, the home was still very much out in the middle of nowhere. "Ina was dirt, two-lane, and like a washboard," said Goldsmith. Tom Peterson, a classmate of the younger Goldsmiths, remembered what visiting his friend entailed. "It was so far away that my dad would take me downtown, and I would get on a Greyhound bus for Phoenix. That's when they went through Florence. And for a quarter, I would ride the bus to Oracle and Ina." After 2 years, the Goldsmiths built a home of their own farther west on Ina Road. The home they had rented went on the market and sold in 1948 to Colonel Robert Bagnell and his wife Eugenia Sullivan Bagnell, formerly of St. Louis. With them came their butler, Levon Bell, who years later remembered picking grapefruit off the trees and taking the family's Airedale into town to have porcupine quills removed. Of all the families associated with the house, the Bagnells lived there the longest. She died in 1962, he 2 years later. Jane Sullivan, the widow of Mrs. Bagnell's son, John, remembered the home, both the way it was when she first saw it as a newlywed back in the late 40s, and the way it looked 15 years later. It was a beautiful home. The house never changed, she said, recalling the rose garden, the night bloom cirrus, and the elegant dinner served by LeVon Bell. Not long before Robert Bagnell died, John and Jane Sullivan moved into a new home on the property, designed by Tucson architect Lewis Hall. Known as the West House, it would later serve as Tohono O'Toole's gift gallery and tea room. Upon his death, Robert Bagnell's home and property went to John Sullivan. Before long, the Sullivans and their children were living in the old adobe-walled home. But the Sullivans were interested in buying a ranch south of Tucson. Once again, the property changed hands. By then, much of the 80 original acres had been chipped away. In 1966, the new owners, Richard and Jean Wilson, began buying some of it back, 36 acres in all. Although they lived in West House for a while, the Wilsons never lived in the main house. After the bookshop they built on the far eastern strip of the property was completed in 1979, the Wilsons decided to put in a nature trail to the west. The rest, they say, is philanthropy. In 1985, the massive house, built, it would seem, on a whim, was lovingly renovated. Rooms where butlers served canapés at elegant soirees and radio scriptwriters turned out next week's Coast to Coast golfs were turned into administrative offices, exhibit space, and a gift shop. Some who once called the place home would see that reincarnation. Some did not. All are glad it survives. Said Jane Sullivan, "I just loved that house. I could have lived there forever." This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.